Poetry on the Radio, poetry in and around the ACT. This week, veteran poet, translator, and all-around man of letters, Keith Harrison. Plus, the Rhyming Bugle, poetry news from around the region. For ArtSound FM, I'm Kimberly K. Williams. Keith Harrison has published 10 collections of poetry, two with Macmillan of London. His acclaimed verse translation of Sir Gawain and the Green Knight is published by Oxford World's Classics. He also has two radio plays and a book on writing called How to Stop Your Papers from Killing You and Me. In 2023, he published an innovative memoir, Not Quite Ithaca, and his poems, translations, and essays have appeared in such publications as The Atlantic Monthly, The New York Times, The Observer, London, and The Australian. An emeritus professor of English and environmental studies at Carleton College in Minnesota and former editor-in-chief of the Carleton Miscellany, he has received awards from the Arts Council of Great Britain, the Minnesota State Arts Council, and the University of Melbourne. Going back some years, he, Scottish poet George Macbeth, and a colleague organized the first international poetry readings at the Edinburgh Festival. Presently living in Canberra, Keith Harrison is working on several books, including a collection of essays and a new and selected poems. To get a sense first of Keith Harrison's writing, let's listen to selections from his recent reading at the Manning Clark House Monthly Poetry Evening.
You'll all remember that Odysseus' journey started from the island of Ithaca, which is off the west coast of Greece, the mainland, and he returned many years later. And my own Odyssey is a very different kind. This book covers a span of almost 90 years. So what I'm planning to do is just to give you a few pieces so that you'll have a little taste of what I'm doing in the book, which consists of prose poems, poems themselves, and pieces of extended prose. I find that at this stage of life, you go through quite a lot of autumnal feeling days. It's not unpleasant, but it's a very different experience from your early, rambunctious, and somewhat mad youth. And that tone permeates some of this book, but it's not entirely like that. This is the poem, and it points to a feeling, I think, that we all have when we stand perhaps on a high hill overlooking the sea, and we can see the shape of our lives just momently. It doesn't last very long, but you have a sense of gratitude and a kind of completeness. When we come home to the good place in ourselves, there's a brown music like the hum of bees. And then the speech of our hands is delicate and sure. We touch our children and our aging fathers. This greeting, this farewell, the cantus firmus on which all our smaller songs depend. We stand here in the courtyard in winter sunlight, carried a moment beyond the edge of speech, carried to a place where sound rises in quiet columns. Clumps of pampas push up from the ground like the heads of giants, our witnesses. The Greeks are in us, and the green bones of our children.
Keith Harrison came to the ArtSound Studios recently, and a long, wide-ranging discussion of his work and thoughts on poetry ensued. Over the next couple of weeks, we'll broadcast excerpts. We began by asking him about his experimental memoir, Not Quite Ithaca, which foregoes the typical approach of memoirs, as he explains. And as he talks about his life, many issues of literary history and craft arise.
Most memoirs are not written in the present tense. They're in the country of was. And most of them tend to be sort of small sagas, so that things are connected through a series of chronological stages. I didn't want to do that. And I thought, what's the best way of writing? And after having thought about it for a long while, and after having read people like James Joyce in The Portrait of the Artist and also Wordsworth's Prelude, Spots of Time was the thing that stuck in my mind. And I thought, the way to go is to just close your eyes and think of memories that flood into your mind so that they seem to be happening right now. Write about that, and then when you've written about it, stop. And then go to the next one. And don't worry about any connecting or chronological, any connective tissue. And so I adopted that procedure pretty well all through. I had to fill in a couple of places because I left out people who were very important and they had to be in there. So I made exceptions in those cases. But generally, I write about things as if they are happening now because that's the way that your memory works. And what you hope is that when you tell it all, with a bit of luck, it'll sort of connect underneath in various ways. And that was what happened, except in one or two places I had to do some juggling with time. But by and large, I followed an overarching sense of the rhythm of time so that the early things are earliest and later things are latest, but that in between it's not nearly so strict. I was worried about whether it was going to work, but most people don't seem to have much trouble with it so far.
You mentioned that there were some episodes or some people that you felt that you really had to include.
Yeah. One of those was a woman called Judy Daniel, who occurs, and I've known her for years, and I've known her in so many ways that there was nothing very specific that came up. That's what I was looking for. There were one or two people who were very close friends, and oddly enough, and to my great annoyance, I left them out altogether because they, again, were so very various in their whole relation to me that I didn't know where to put you. You've had that experience where if you ask, you know, who are your closest friends, sometimes you leave the very closest out because you're dealing with you take them for granted.
Yes.
And I felt guilty about that. It's so important that I didn't put them in.
I was particularly interested in important moments in letters you've been there for. Your early friendships, your acquaintanceships with various people like Ted Hughes and Sylvia Plath.
No, I read a lot of official biographies about Hughes and Plath, not for the sake of, you know, writing this book, but I got a little bit hooked on them because I knew David Wevel and Assia Wevel very well, and they were involved in the whole Hughes Plath saga for a number of years in a number of ways, and I knew them very well, and so I got interested. But I found most of the official biographies didn't interest me any more than the Bloomsbury Group biographies do, because you don't always deal with the most interesting ideas or the most interesting people at their most interesting times. So you get a lot of high-class gossip, and I didn't want to write about that. I wanted to write about just my own personal experience with them. And with the case of Sylvia Plath, it wasn't all that pleasant. It wasn't unpleasant, but it had a very strong edge to it because I made the mistake of asking her where Ted was that evening, just a few weeks after Ted and Sylvia had split up, so she was pretty sensitive about it.
It's enlightening to know that all these events that were happening with her and her relationships had a very mundane aspect to them.
They did. In fact, many years before, I'd read The Bell Jar, which is largely autobiographical, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I'd also read some letters that she'd written. She published a book of letters at the time that we were both in England, and I hadn't met her then, and I thought, what a banal series of events. She talks about Thanksgiving ceremonies and the first time she rode a horse and that kind of thing. And it was very ordinary kind of stuff, I thought. And I believe that what happened when she met Hughes, that he brought her to life in the sense that he made her sharpen up her whole approach to poetry. So she took that aspect of his art, which is very well developed, and used it for her own work. But my trouble with Plath had always been that her focus was rather narrow. It seemed to be mainly herself and her angst and pain, that kind of thing. But there wasn't much about other people.
I'm smiling because when I read her work, that is what I struggle with. I feel left out. I feel like I'm a voyeur.
Yes.
And it's so uncomfortable.
And I feel that somewhat with all the confessional poets, Perryman and Sexton and Plath, as if I'm committing some kind of a solecism, just entering their private territory. And that's their fault, I think.
Yes, I think that the risk there is that it shuts out the reader. Mm. And if the reader wants to participate in that kind of voyeurism, they can. But I once taught in the United States, I taught a women's literature class, and I could not figure out how to get my head around Plath in order to teach her successfully.
Well, you have to know, Kimberly, that we would have thousands of enemies.
I know.
If we were.
I don't usually say that, let alone on radio.
Because for my students, the vast majority of them, mainly women, but not all women, they were a cult of Sylvia Plath, really.
I'm going to say this. She was, I think, a fabulous technician. But in terms of sort of the effect her poems have on me, or the aesthetic, all the extra layers of ways that poetry affects you, I feel left out.
And it's largely a matter of temperament, because there are so many people who disagree with this. So that there must be something that they get from it that I'm not able to share.
Same.
Because I happen to believe in that poetry should inhabit a world which is a bit like Chaucer's or Shakespeare's. It's got a breadth, and it's got a variety of different characters, and there's a dramatic quality to so much.
As you're speaking, what I'm imagining is bridges. Works where the poets have built bridges, and you can elect to cross them or not.
Yeah.
But if you do, then there's a connection.
Yeah.
It's a kind of an offering. Keith Harrison spent many years in Great Britain, and then in a region of the United States that not many Australian writers find their way to, the Midwest, including at the renowned Writers' Workshop at the University of Iowa, and then teaching for many years at Carleton College in Minnesota.
Yes, there were very few of us. I first went to the Writers' Workshop at Iowa City, and I don't think there are any other Australians there. There were a few in the East Coast, I think, but most Australians at that period when I went, which was the almost exactly contemporaneous with Barry Humphreys, and a few other painters who went, in fact, a lot, including Clive James, went in that 10-year period when I was in it. But then I began to go to the same literary parties in London and meet the same people, and English poetry at that stage wasn't terribly adventurous, whereas what was going on in the States was, I think. There was still some good poetry being written in the 80s, and I found Iowa City a very interesting place to be. It was very untidy, and it was very uneven in its talent, but some of the talents were really quite prominent and remarkable. And they'd had some people there, including Robert Lowell at Iowa, and also his pupil Snodgrass. And they were very, very prominent in, a change in Lowell's poetry. It was really Snodgrass who turned him on to talking about himself more. And then Lowell joined the confessional group, at least for a few books he did, in Life Studies and so on. Mm. And I'm not sure still whether they are the better poems. I think some of them have the same kind of personal grit and uncomfortableness that we find in the later James Macaulay poems, who went a little bit in that direction in Australia, but his early verse was not like that at all. It was much more sculpted and classical and traditional rhymes and so on. But then Lowell just broke out in Life Studies and wrote in a very, very untidy kind of way, but it was... He had a long discipline in traditional verse, so he was a good craftsman as well. But I'm still not known. I'm still not sure whether it produced better poetry. What do you think about late Lowell?
I don't mind it, but I don't. To me, it's something I study.
Yeah.
But not something that I embrace or return to.
But the rhetoric of a Quaker graveyard at Nantucket and so on, it's really. Post-Yeatsian, it's got a kind of fullness about it, but some people don't like that. I know Peter Porter didn't like Yeats at all, and I think it was that kind of thing.
Well, I adore Yeats. See, Yeats I'll return to again and again.
Yes.
My whole life.
As you just mentioned some of those other poets, it reminds me of an aspect of your biography which is quite striking. Various poets that you knew when you're at university, for example, in Melbourne, they went to London. They went to the perceived yep. centre of the literary world. You went to the American Midwest.
That was after I'd been in London for quite a number of years, yes. And the Midwest was not in itself a great centre for poetry, but the Writers' Workshop was, I think, a pretty daring thing that Paul Engle pulled off there, yes. Definitely. And lots of people followed him. He was a very equivocal figure, to Paul Engle. He had an eye for what he thought was promise, and he paid generously. And oddly enough, he wrote, after writing a lot of bad poems, he wrote some very good poems about visiting Japan. And he was very good to his writers, but out of sympathy with the English department, which he worked for.
I have to ask, right, Minnesota, did you know Robert Bly?
Very well, yeah.
Damn.
I got a very good letter from Robert not long before he died, because I'd written an essay on Reed Whittemore, who was the equivalent of the poet laureate, and who was also a member of the faculty at Carleton College, and was also the editor of the Carleton Miscellany. And I wrote that he wrote an autobiography in which he calls himself he. It's the only autobiography I know in which it's written in the third person. Pretty unusual.
Mm.
And I wrote a review, which I thought was pretty good, and Robert wrote me a very sweet note about it after a time when he himself had contracted some rather difficult mental troubles. But it was a very courteous note, and I bumped into him a good number of times, and he even introduced me to Thomas Tranströmer, whom I didn't mention, I think, in my memoir. And Tranströmer was a very good poet.
Oh, he was wonderful.
Yeah, yes, he's wonderful.
Oh, gosh. Now I read Tranströmer, talk about bridges, and I get goosebumps just crossing them. I got to meet Bly once, and I was with students, and he was so kind to my students. But I think of Bly as just probably the greatest American advocate for poetry in the 20th century. He brought the whole rest of the world's poems to the U.S.
I think you're right, because he introduced us not only to South American poetry, but to a lot of Central European and particularly Scandinavian poetry.
That's right.
And he translated Tranströmer pretty well, I think.
Yes.
He was an equivocal and strange figure, but always entertaining. And when I wrote that spoof and Basho attempts to translate Robert Bly, a friend came across Bly at a reading in Wisconsin, and he said to him, "Can you read that poem that Keith wrote a little bit of a satire on?" And he said, "Keith didn't understand what I was saying." Which was partly true, because I was taking some strange things that he said, like, "The lamplight falls on all fours on the grass," you know, and things like that, which sounded magical. Then you looked at them and they kind of dissolved.
Fall apart. Yep.
He wrote a lot of poems that do have some magic in them, but when you look at the magic, it fades a little bit. But he wrote a few which generally work very well.
I think. Who am I to judge Robert Bly? But my assessment would be he has a handful of really great poems.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was just a tremendous translator. And I see him more as just a prominent advocate and champion.
And editor.
Yeah.
Yeah, Robert, we miss him a lot. He's great. Mm.
You alluded to one aspect of Bly's life, some struggles that he had, and just in our conversation so far, that issue has come up a few times of poets who really struggled with mental health. There's a curious few pages in your own memoir where you talk about an incident in a sense of hallucination or of losing your grip on reality.
Yes, we had a cat. I don't like cats, but we had a cat, in a family animal who we were at loggerheads. And when my wife and the kids left and I was alone in the house, the cat decided that he would get at me. And I explained that very carefully, what happens. And the cat haunted me for a long while, and I had this sense that he used to follow me everywhere I went, even though I was in Australia. And I don't believe in ghosts or any of that stuff, but it was a very powerful sense, and I felt I had to write about it. It was a feeling of being a little bit out of it and not knowing where I was and being definitely hazed by an animal, you know.
I don't get the sense that you would argue that poetry is particularly dangerous to mental health. It is striking, though, how many of the great poets, even the ones you knew, did have those struggles. It's not a life that lends itself to stability in many ways.
That's very interesting you say that, because Wallace Stevens talks about poetry as dangerous. It can kill a man. And there's no sign of that in his own work, of anything like that. And I think one of the greatest of all, John Sebastian Bach, someone wrote a poem about him and says he's constantly singing the joy of being sane. And that was not a fashionable thing in the 60s or even in the 19th century. It was supposed to be a divine madness. But And Shelley certainly had some of that. And I don't think Wordsworth did. And it doesn't seem to have very much to do with the greatness or smallness of the poetry produced, but there was this sense of poetry and madness being aligned. I've never thought it was very, very interesting. I think the hardest thing in life is to try to be sane and to try to be balanced, but you should take some risks too. I think you should go out on the edge a bit. But you've got to get back if you can.
Your memoir speaks to your success in that. It's a memoir of a very long life. Not all poets that we know have that much time to reflect on what their life has been and the life in letters.
Hardy's a wonderful counterexample, isn't he? Hardy wrote his last volume of verse at the age of 89. I'm trying to beat him by going to 91, 92. Not sure that I'll make it. But
well, let's talk then about what you have coming. You have a collected poems of a kind coming, or selected? Tell us about that.
I've got a selected poems coming, and I'm going to include the new ones and all the ones I want to keep from the previous books. So it'll be really in three parts. There'll be some new poems at the beginning. There'll be a big meat of the sandwich of all the older poems, and then some new poems at the end. I wanted to do it that way because I want readers to pick up something and see something new, you know, and then maybe finish with something new. So I don't know whether it's going to work, but I hope it will. And I originally chose it to be 99 poems because Seamus Heaney just bought out a volume before he died. In fact, he didn't. His family brought it out, called 100 Poems. And then various other people have done 99 poems, and I thought, maybe that'll be a good idea, but now I've decided I think I'll just call it by a name. I'm not sure how I'll go.
We're going to ask you about particular books you had, you've published, but perhaps I can ask this introductory question. You've had a very long career, so your interests have been many, but have there been particular interests or fascinations that you've pursued in your poetry over the years and decades?
That's a very good question, because I've often asked myself that, because when you're in the middle of things, you can't see yourself very clearly. But I keep on coming back to what I would call somewhat earthy kinds of poems, many of which are not included in here. And I saw that film the other night called Rachel's Farm, and that brought me back to, you know, the realities of the land. I've worked a bit on the land. I'm not a farmer. But I come from a family that has had some experience on the land. And so I keep on coming back to that. And I like to have imagery of landscapes where I've been in poems. It's just something that I do naturally. So that's a common theme. And you'll find a number of poems throughout my work. Not a great number, but poems like Not Quite Ithaca and a whole range of smaller poems are about particular places. So yes, that's a common theme. But then I've always had this sense that I want to be very mischievous and go out on the edge and try things out. And one of the things that I haven't talked about here or anywhere else is I've done a lot of visual poems, and I'm going to bring those together in a book as well. and what I call sound poems, and there's one sound poem in there, Tattvamasi, in which I play with language. So I like to push language in two ways, toward the visual and towards the nonsensical, and just to see what happens. And it's really, some of my favourite poems are nonsensical ones, like "'Twas Brillig and the Slithy Toes," and the greatest mistake that Lewis Carroll, the greatest mistake that he made was to translate that poem into English, because it's very meaningful the way that it is, even though many of the words are not in the language at all. But I like that kind of play, and there was some of that went on in the 60s, and Christopher Smart and a number of other English poets do that. Skelton is another one, and I like and on the lighter side, I think that the best of our friend Ogden Nash, when he says things like, "To see a great sea monster before I die is the thing I want to." I would have loved to have written that, and many other poems, and particularly the one where he talks about Cooper making that Hemingway kind of love. And he has this passage where the seagull met an eagle in an igloo way up north. The seagull eyed the eagle, and the following words came forth, and she makes this big spiel. And he says, "Go tell it to the lemming, go chant it to the dove, I'm looking for that Hemingway kind of love." I mean, that's just genius. It's just marvellous. And I don't know why Ogden Nash has faded off, but I found a possible answer. I went to the library a few weeks ago, and I've got a whole lot of his books, and I found so many dull poems in there. I couldn't believe it, because what we tend to hear is the great ones, and he wrote a lot of great ones. He really did.
And so the conversation went, and we were just getting started. Do come back next week to Poetry on the Radio as we continue to talk with veteran man of letters, Keith Harrison. I'm Kimberly K. Williams.
The Rhyming Bugle at Smith's Alternative in Civic on Monday, November 6 at 7 p.m. Jeff Page's long-running monthly series will feature Jeff Goodfellow and Russell Owen. Jeff Goodfellow, from Adelaide, seeks to give voice to people who generally would not go anywhere near poetry. His Poems for a Dead Father were shortlisted in 2002 for the Age Book of the Year Award. Russell Owen is a small farmer in the southern tablelands of New South Wales who has published four collections. A fifth, Within Reach, will appear early in 2024. The Canberra-based early music consort, Apeiron Baroque, is holding an evening of music and poetry at Wesley Music Centre in Forest, Sunday, November 12 at 5 p.m. Apeiron Baroque will be joined by the hosts of Art Sounds Poetry on the Radio, Kimberly K. Williams and Peter Searles, as well as local poets Penelope Leyland and Jackie Malins, to present poems from the newly published Book of Birds anthology from Recent Work Press. Go online to Apeiron Baroque, Apeiron Baroque. This month's poetry reading at Manning Clark House on Thursday, November 23 at 7 p.m. will feature Anne M. Carson and Angela Costi from Victoria and Amelia Walker from South Australia. Applications are open for the Helen Ann Bell Poetry Bequest Award for Female Poets, hosted biennially by the University of Sydney. Australia's richest poetry cash prize, the Bell Award offers $40,000 to the author of a collection of poems reflecting Australian culture. Entries close on Monday, December 18. Search online for University of Sydney Helen Ann Bell Poetry Bequest Award 2023. Poetry on the Radio is produced weekly on unceded traditional land in the studios of ArtSound FM and airs Sundays at 4:30 p.m. and again at 10:30 p.m. on Mondays and online at artsound.fm. Series hosts are Kimberly K. Williams and Peter Searles, who produced the program with me, Peter Monahan. Find out more on the Poetry on the Radio page under the Programs tab at artsound.fm. Our theme is an imagining of an ancient Greek hymn to the muse Calliope by Gregoria Paniagua and the Atrium Musica de Madrid.